Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hey Trailblazers, this is Jason, your host of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. Before we jump into our latest episode, I've got some incredible news for you. Are you gearing up for your next big hike or backpacking trip? Well, we at Trailblazing Texas podcast have partnered up with Trekker Joe's, the ultimate Texas outfitter, to bring you something I feel absolutely special. Listeners, you of the Trailblazing Texas podcast can now get a one-time 15% off their gear purchases at Trekker Joe's. That's right. Whether you're a first-time customer at Trekker Joe's or a repeat customer like me, you can save big and hit the trails well-prepared. So upon checkout, use code TTP15 to claim your 15% discount and, in the process, support an amazing local Texas business. So happy trails, and don't forget to tell your hiking buddies. Now on with the episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode. So I've been doing a lot of research, and I've found that there's a lot of debate around experience versus certifications. So where do you stand on that argument for a guide to have the experience versus having the certifications?
Well, I don't love the argument because it's not one or the other, right? Like if it's like you can absolutely be certified and have lots of experience. In fact, that would be the norm if you're certified. The outliers, like the rare case scenarios, are going to be your certified guides that don't really have a whole lot of experience, and then your experienced guides that don't have a certification, right? So that's what we're talking about. The vast majority of certified guides are going to be very experienced. Just because for most people, it takes, you know, anywhere from a reasonable amount of time, might be like 6 or 7 years to finish the process. I finished it in 10. So, you know, what I will say is there are a lot of really experienced guides that are not certified. And remember, like certification would be not necessarily like fully certified, like an IFMGA certified guide. So having all the disciplines covered, like there are a lot of like single discipline certified guides out there. Like they only do skiing or they only do snowboarding or, you know, they only do ice climbing or whatever. And I think that was more common in the past. And so there, you know, there's kind of like, it's kind of like that generation where it was a little more common to not be certified, but be experienced. That generation is kind of like retiring out for the most part. And I will say that there does seem to be more of the newer generation seeking certification. And so there, I think that the trend is moving towards it, but, you know, it's really not one or the other, right? And when you're talking experience, it's not just like what mountains have you climbed, it's what have you guided and what types of training have you had in guiding. Right, because guiding and climbing are two different things.
Yeah. What do you think is more dangerous? Having experience and no, I guess, professional training or certifications, or having all the certifications but don't have as much experience?
Me personally, knowing what I know, I would, if it was just like, I was hiring a guide, and you know, I could just either pick one that's been in guiding for a long time or one that is certified, and I didn't know who those guides were. I think I would pick the guide that's certified, just because that guide has had other certified guides look at their work and say, yeah, this person can do the job. And with just the experienced guide that's been in the game for a long time, it's like they very well might be the best guide in the country, you know, but you don't know. They could not be very good at it at all, you know, because they're operating in an industry that does not require any standards of them. Does that make sense? So it's just too much of a hit or miss. So if I was hiring a guide for myself or a loved one or family member, it would definitely be a certified guide, whether they were experienced or not, even if it was their first day of work, right? Like somebody has looked at what they do, technically speaking, and are like, yes, this is the standard that we're trying to work towards.
I think you just answered the next question. So it was, you know, basically me as a client, why should I care that my guide is certified or not? And I think you nailed it. And it's exactly what, like, just me not being a guide, but just being kind of hopefully a logical thinker, that the person that has, that is certified, has had more than just one person review their work and have passed them.
Yeah. And they're committed to a peer review process willingly.
Yeah.
Right. Like, they're somebody that is looking to be better, right? That's why they're there. And so the chances that they do a good job for you are probably going to be higher.
So just to the listeners, let's say we have some Trailblazing Texas podcast listeners that want to go get into mountaineering. What are some of the top things that clients should be asking when they're talking to these guiding companies or guides that, I guess they all work for a company, but like, so what are some of the top things that we should be looking out for?
Well, I will say that it's pretty common for guides to have a social media presence of some sort. And so let's say, you know, you're looking to book a trip with, you know, Peak Baggers International, right? Let's just use a hypothetical. Right? You can go on their website, and usually, I can't imagine that there's any guiding companies that don't have a visible roster, but I would suggest that you go on the company's website that you're interested in booking with. Maybe before you even get there, you would want to compare the different companies, just like their website. How does that look? Like, you know, word of mouth. Have you heard good things about this company, this, that, and the other thing? And you could also look for things like AMGA accreditation. So with the AMGA accreditation process, a guiding service has to have X number of, X percent compliance of SOP. And then there's other like background kind of like policies and procedures that have to be in line with the AMGA's kind of ethical thing and legal stuff as well. As far as I understand, I'm not a business owner, so I've never really seen that end. But once you've kind of like seen, okay, well, I'm thinking about going with Peak Baggers International, right? So then you'd go on their website and you can find, you know, a roster typically. And so I would highly recommend, and I don't think many clients do this, but, you know, going onto the website and really just looking through the roster, right? And reading the bios. If you see one that you kind of like, maybe follow them on Instagram, follow them on Facebook, whatever Instagram, you know, whatever social media they're taking part in. And honestly, don't be afraid to reach out to a guide directly. Like, I just wish more clients did that, to be honest, because in that scenario, you would essentially almost, you wouldn't be guaranteed to work with the guide that you want to work with, but you stand a pretty good chance, right? Like if I had my name on a guiding services roster on the website and they reached out to me directly, then I would say, hey, like, you know, yeah, I'm available on this date and this date for this objective that you're talking about wanting to climb. And you should reach out to my employer and request me by name. And any good guiding service is going to give you a bonus for having brought that client in. And so I end up getting paid more, or the guide that you pick gets paid more. They're stoked going into the trip that they're getting paid more. They're stoked that you've already, you know, they've already been in contact with you directly. They're going to just feel like they know you a little bit better. And you get to, you know, you get to pick the cream of the crop, you know? So I think that's really underutilized, and I don't know why.
That was something that I always wondered about. If you are working or as a guide, are working for Peak Baggers International, and friends, family, whoever wanted to hire you, like that, you know, I guess it would always go through the company, and then that would be set up that way. And hopefully you would just be put into that group as the guide.
Yeah, it really depends on the objective and the time of year and the nature of like the business that is going on that time of year. Like if you were to reach out to Timberline, say on Mount Hood, in, you know, I don't know, March, it might be difficult for you to get me in May, right? I might be like, they might just be like, hey, I'm sorry, we can't like guarantee any guides. We have everyone on our roster is trained within the SOP. You're going to end up with a good guide. But like, if you want a guide, you know, you know, we've got one slot left for you or something like that. You know, it's just not going to be that easy. But if you were to reach out in like the later part of the season when things have quieted down a little bit for most companies, you stand a much higher chance of being able to pick your guide, right? That's the other thing too, is like the big ticket climbs like Hood, Rainier, they're beautiful climbs. They're great climbs. But I think they're mostly popular because they're the highest points in their respective states. But they don't really make great first mountaineering objectives. Like Hood is, you know, a little bit better, I guess. But like just because it's just the one day. But it's kind of a lot, like in terms of technical, you know, like you're going to get a lot of exposure. You're going to, you know, really be introduced to a lot of different systems. And then Rainier is just like very big, right? So it's like, if you've never done anything even remotely close to that size, you know, like you're just spending a lot of money. You can't really pick your guide. It's like, you know, like there's this like machine that's running and you need to like fit into that machine or else they're just going to turn you around, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas if you like wait until like the main seasons are over, like people aren't really climbing Rainier and they're not really climbing Hood anymore. You know, like the big things are slowing down and then you like reach out, hire the guide that you want for, you know, and you could even ask them like, hey, like I'd like to get into this. You know, it's me and my buddy. What would be a good route? What would you suggest that we go and do as like a first climb? That's just going to be a much more like tailored experience. And I just think you're going to have a much better outcome, or at least a higher likelihood of a better outcome.
Yeah, I definitely think for me, coming from Texas with limited snow traverse and stuff, like just going up to Muir Snowfield or as high as we got, it was a lot. So, you know, I had that experience. And then I was just in Poland and in some snow and done some 14ers in snow and stuff. And I'm not saying my skills have improved at all, but I do find mentally that I'm a lot more comfortable than what I was with John on Rainier. And, you know, we've talked about that. Talking to people in Colorado, and I think you're absolutely right. High points, the 14,000 foot, I mean, that like just draws us, you know, and even in like Colorado, talking to people in Colorado, they're like, man, there's so much more more beautiful scenery or better climbs than just doing a 14er. Like the 13ers, mm-hmm. the 12,000 foot peaks are just as challenging, even sometimes even more challenging. And if you just go for, I don't know, bagging the highest, you're missing out on a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a reason to get involved in either. The way I kind of break down mountain climbing in general is like your high elevation, kind of like summit oriented, like high point oriented thing, like high elevation expedition climbing. And then there's like more of like your technical, more obscure, maybe more like adventure climbing. And depending on what you're after, there's two different like kind of pathways, if you will, right? If you're wanting to get into like the more technical adventure climbing, then there's, you know, a mountain like Rainier, it's like cool, it'd be a good experience, but like it's not really on that track. Whereas like if you're going down the expedition track, it's very much a part of that track. Like you should go and do that and then like kind of work your way up. And you know, I typically don't really do a whole lot in like the high elevation expedition realm. You know, it's just not what really draws me in. But there's kind of two different worlds for the folks that are potentially getting into it.
So for this next question, I kind of have an answer, but I'm interested to see, and we've kind of touched on a little bit of this, I think. So in your opinion, what are the benefits of working with a certified guide from a professional perspective? And let me give you my answer and you tell me if I'm right or not. I would say for me, working with a certified guide, it would almost guarantee me, in my mind, it would almost guarantee that the guide that I've just hired has put their hands on anything and everything that we may be encountering. And probably has, you know, been signed off on, yes, you know how to do this. Yes, you know how to do that. And if I look at someone that just has a lot of experience, I think that maybe there could be situations where they've never experienced or ran across.
I think you're on to something to a point. I think that there, I wouldn't be able to say that you would be guaranteed that your certified guide is going to have experienced everything that you might experience out there, just because, you know, certification is really, you know, it's really just kind of like the beginning in terms of like all the lessons that you stand to learn out there. They tend to be like more like fine tuning sorts of things that you're learning. Like you shouldn't be like, oh, I didn't know that a rope would, you know, like behave this way. You know what I mean? Like with a uncertified guide, think of it like back to like the doctor analogy. If you need heart surgery, would you rather have a general practitioner or like a, you know, just a family doc that I think like part of med school would probably be that they like have at least seen surgeries like that and kind of know what the procedure mostly looks like? Or would you rather have the surgeon that works on hearts? You know, like you're just going to have a higher likelihood of a better outcome, right? There's probably heart surgeons that aren't very good at heart surgery, and there's probably family docs that could probably perform heart surgery just fine. But, you know, I think that like just the very fact that they pursued the certification process, and there's no one that's saying that they must in order to guide at all, says a lot about that person, I think, just in general, right? Like they care that they are operating at a high level. So yeah, like don't be surprised if you're out with a certified guide and they're like, oh, I've never seen that before. Like that's not uncommon.
So how can, or how do you think the industry or even a podcast like this help promote better awareness about hiring trained and certified guides? And do you think it's a responsibility that, I don't know, the industry or mountaineering podcasts, they have a responsibility?
I don't necessarily think it's the responsibility of podcasts like this. I do think that it is unfortunately going to be the responsibility of the people who hire guides, like as a whole, to become educated in what it's all about. I really, unfortunately, I've lost faith in the guiding industry handling it internally, just because most of the folks with lots of kind of like power and authority and I don't know what the word is, like political capital, they either don't really want the thing to change or they don't need the industry to change, one or the other. And then I kind of like go either way. Like it might come from the government. It might come from like the land management side. It might come from maybe like the insurance side, if there's like enough high profile accidents. But really the most surefire way is just going to be like the market, right? Like if people educate themselves and realize, wow, like you absolutely could get somebody who knows nothing about guiding that's guiding you up this mountain. What does it take to get a certified guide? You know, I should ask for it. Oh, do you have a certified guide? Cool. I'm going to work with that person. If they don't, then maybe you're like, well, I'm going to go and check with a couple other guide services and see if I can get a certified guide for this. So that would be like a surefire way if anyone wanted to do it. And that like one trip is like a big deal, right? Like if you call a guide service and you're like, I need a certified guide for this objective. And they're like, well, we can't provide you with a certified guide. Then just say like, well, I'm going to just continue shopping around. Thank you. That's a huge, that would actually be like a very large impact, I think. Just one person just like randomly could do.
Just like loss of business is a red, you know, that kind of opens up the eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I really like this next question because I definitely have an opinion on it, but it'd be interesting to get your opinion, especially for as long as you've been doing this. So how do you think social media and influencer or the influencer culture has helped or hurt the perception of guiding?
I don't know. I have like mixed feelings about social media just because like it's not really my bag. Like I have an Instagram and like, you know, I've at times been fairly active with it. Just because I think that the people who do follow me seem like they get a lot out of the things I was posting. But, you know, you do have, you know, I guess the reason I'm like, I get weird with social media is there are like quite a few guides that are really good at self-promotion. And I probably don't like it because I'm not good at it, to be completely fair and honest. I do also think that some guides that are really good at self-promotion might not be that good at guiding. And then the media, you know, like people just see the stuff on social media and they're like, well, this is the guide that's posting all the things, so that must be the best guide out there. I'm going to reach out to them. And I would just say, like, just keep in mind that, like, running an effective social media platform is like a skill set. And that skill set really isn't part of guiding, right? It's like you could hire somebody to do that for you, right? That's like a lot of people's job title is like social media, you know, like I don't know, director or whatever. But I think generally though, there's been a lot of really good content, like really good, like technical content. Like a lot of guides were doing like Tech Tips Tuesdays or whatever, just to kind of like drive some, you know, interaction. And I think that like through things like that, it just like, you know, some of those videos, they just go viral. And as long as that video, as long as like the tech tip is actually like sound, then it absolutely can get a lot of really good information into like a lot of people's minds that wouldn't otherwise have access to it. You know, simple things like backing up a rappel. And I bet there's like thousands of people that have learned like basic like skill sets that have probably kept them alive because they saw it on like Instagram Reel or something like that. You know, so I think it's been good for the most part. I just have mixed feelings, you know, for I'm not a big self-promoter.
I think I tend to agree with you that there's a lot of things that social media brings awareness to. But also I find, and I can only relate it to hiking and backpacking, that some posts, reels, videos, I think it does a disservice to what it actually took to get here or hike this, or, you know, it's somebody's posting a video at Guadalupe Mountains or Big Bend. It's in June or July, and they're like, oh yeah, yeah, and it's, you know, it's really like 119 degrees. There's no shade. And yeah, you may have made it, but now you've just kicked off somebody going, oh, well, look, this guy hiked and backpacked and, you know, in July and at Big Bend. I'm going to take the kids and I'm going to go do it. Maybe not understand the research that needs to be involved and stuff. So, you know, I definitely think you can learn a lot, but I also definitely think that if you're not a person that has the experience, or you're not a person that just on your own dives down that rabbit hole for researching and trying to get the information, that it could really backfire on you, I guess.
Oh, totally. I mean, you got to remember, like social media is like one little glimpse. It's like, it's just like, you know, when people are like, wow, that person looks so happy and their life is so nice on social media. But like, you're just seeing like the one curated thing, right? And that's true for like climbing pictures and like skiing pictures and all that stuff too. It's like, you know, I actually do like to share like some of like the gnarlier, grittier parts of my adventures as like the highlight of trips. Just because that's like my personality. But, you know, I think typically people are like, they could like ski like 50 feet of powder and like the whole rest of the 7,000 foot descent would be like total garbage. And they would like post like the picture of the powder turns, you know? And so I think that like you said, you know, like it's just really not like rainbows and unicorns up there. You don't know what goes into like how they got to where they took that shot.
I just can go back and just, you know, when I first met John and we were talking about mountaineering and stuff, I started just Googling mountaineering at some of these famous volcanoes and the deaths. I mean, that's crazy, the amount of people that have lost their life. And I'm not even talking like worldwide, just in the United States, in Colorado and Hood and some of these places, that I often wonder when someone does this type of activity. And I would guess that a lot of them, you know, or it's their first time and it ends up like that. Like what got them into jumping in and just doing that, or maybe not building up to, or did they even understand the risks of the activity, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I often will like think about like my early progression and I'm like, man, like there are so many hairball incidents where I like just barely made it or like could have easily made serious mistakes. Like I went years and years rappelling like big multi-pitch rock routes without like putting knots in the end of my rope.
What?
Yeah. I would just rappel down and I was like, well, I'll hold on to the rope and nothing bad will happen. You know?
Brandon?
I just didn't have a lot of training. You know, so much of it I just learned on my own. And like, you know, I was like young and brazen and eager and whatnot, but man, like there are so many times where I could have been just like an accident, you know. And one thing that happens fairly often that it's almost like it happens every year is like, people are like trying to rappel like a double length rappel, right? Like, so two ropes tied together and they're rappelling. What they do is they mistakenly just tie the two ropes together with a figure eight. And it's not like what we call like a Flemish bend, which would be like two opposing figure eights tied together in a way that the figure eight would stay correctly oriented. It's essentially tied together like in line, or not in line, but like, sorry, I'm going to have a hard time explaining this, but they just take the two ropes and tie a figure eight in it and they call it good. Mm-hmm. And what happens is when you load that knot in that orientation where you're pulling it side to side and the knot is in the middle, it rolls like, and it unravels.
Oh, geez.
And it, you know, people think like, oh, it's a figure eight. A figure eight's a figure eight. Like, that's a good knot for rock climbing. It's just not being used in the correct way. Whereas like a simpler, scarier looking knot called an overhand knot, which you really wouldn't use for any other application, really. Like, if you tie your two ropes together with that knot, you're fine. In fact, that's the preferred method.
Wow.
You know? And yeah, it's just, I think the other thing too that bothers me a bit is, and it's kind of on this topic, is like, and it's, don't get me wrong here, it's like completely amazing what the top level athletes are doing. And I'm not going to like name names or anything. I think that when you're a top level athlete and you're in a movie, let's say, and you're doing cutting edge like alpinism, to perform those feats, you're going to be employing strategies and techniques, like technical strategies and techniques and gear in such a way that you're really like either completely outside the actual like manufacturer's recommendation for how that gear is supposed to be used, or you're like right on the edge of what it's supposed to be used like, right? It's not like they're doing it wrong. Like they understand, like if you're at that level, you understand what it is you're risking and how you're going to try and mitigate that risk. But that message doesn't get through in a movie, right? There's usually not like an interview with them where they're like explaining like, hey, if you're new to this sport, this isn't how you should like go climbing, right? But when you're, you know, a 16-year-old version of me and you see that on a movie, you're like, I want to do that. That looks awesome. And you just like would have like no way to do that right, you know? So it's like that stuff does bother me a little bit for sure. Like there should absolutely be like some sort of a message either from the manufacturer of the gear that's being used or like from the athletes themselves, like before or after the movie, that's like, hey, you saw like some pretty like gnarly stuff and that's not how you should be like operating it at this, you know, here's how it could have gone wrong.
It's got to have been about 6 months ago, and I don't know when the accident actually happened, but there was a famous rock climber and they had a multi-pitch and they were both going down at the same time. So they had two ropes connected and the seasoned rock climber didn't put an end knot in his rope. So as they were going down, he went off the rope, which then made this guy fall. And so the professional rock climber guy ended up dying. And the guy that was with him, who wasn't like, I would even say that it was kind of like, maybe it was his friend and he was kind of new to all this rock climbing, but he fell. And the only reason why he didn't die was because a bush caught him that was just growing out of the rock.
That's another technique. That's exactly the type of thing I'm talking about, is where it's like, it's common to see it on like a big screen, and like it's such a risky maneuver for such little gain. Right? Like if I like really like say there's a lightning storm or something and I was like, hey, we need to get off this thing like right now, like let's tandem repel this. I might do it, but it's probably not that much faster, to be completely honest. Like, cause there's just so much like futzing around when you're doing it like that. I think that honestly, if I just like grabbed both strands and rappelled like as fast as I could, I'd get down real fast. And then if you were also doing that, you'd get down real fast and it would be like a very safe process.
Yeah. And I'm going to try to find it to try to understand why they did it, but yeah, it's just didn't tie an end knot and just boop.
I mean, I've absolutely done it. And I think that the reasoning is just like efficiency and like, and honestly, it's not really that much more efficient. And you stand the risk of like you and the other person both dying, you know?
Oh.
So it's, I really wouldn't recommend it.
You heard it here on the Trailblazing Texas podcast.
Yeah.
Don't do that. If you could change one thing about the way guiding is marketed or regulated, I know we've kind of touched on some of these things, like, so, but what's kind of what really important to you and what would it be?
Man, honestly, like if the scope of practice would just really take hold, and if clients were just more educated and like really held that standard on the industry, it would make them have a better, safer experience, and it would make the industry much more sustainable for the guides. And so you're going to end up with safer trips, and you're going to end up, well, it's just going to like, it's going to feed on itself, right? Because like more higher trained, experienced guides are going to stay in the industry longer, right? Because there is a higher demand for the thing that they offer. Right. But with the mindset of like a mountain guide is a mountain guide is a mountain guide, just because this company says they're a mountain guide, that they're, you know, for this trip, that just keeps the bar really low, you know? And then you're always competing with like the it's a race to the bottom. You're competing with the bottom, you know? But yeah, you know, I think that's what I would want to change.
And to the listeners, if you're planning on hiring a guide, act like it's going to be your heart surgeon.
Yeah.
You know, take it with that much seriousness that,
yeah,
that it's someone that's going to be doing the, you know, something that important to you, and do the research. Yeah, I totally agree to that. Mm-hmm. So this is not the 20-year-old Brandon. This is me coming up to you and saying, hey, Brandon, I want to quit my cush job, and I want to get into mountaineering guiding, and I want to do it right. What advice would you give me?
Well, I would say, like, keep climbing and skiing. You know, do that as much as you can, because you're gonna need to use that experience, you know, in the future. And then I would for sure, you know, just recommend that they go and check out the AMGA website and see, like, you know, what the guiding progression for training looks like. See what the prerequisites are for the different courses that you might need to get into. And I would also direct you towards where you'd get your medical training and your avalanche awareness training. So that would be the companies that I use for those are Wilderness Medicine Institute, which is like a branch off of Knowles. So they're just WMI, and they offer like a woofer, which is like your minimum standard for a guide. And that's your medical training. And then I've done most of my training for avalanche, with, ARI. So the American Institute for Avalanche Research and Education. I'm also an educator for them as well. And There's also the American Avalanche Institute. They do a good job. They did both of my pro level trainings. But yeah, I would just say start with what you know. I think that like it's pretty hard to get into the AMGA as a skier alone right now, just because there's like a lot of people who want to get into the ski industry. So I would say, you know, try and get to a point where you can meet the minimum qualifications as a climber to do one of like the little branch courses that they offer into the program. But yeah, it is hard to get in just like with your first course being like the ski guide course, for instance. So yeah, I would just say, you know, keep climbing, keep skiing, and then look into those certifications and trainings. And then, you know, the other piece of advice I would give them is, and don't forget that you also need another way to make a living. And I think that's really important. And I wish that like I had been like more kind of like focused on that from the onset. You know, just putting in a little bit of effort over the course of your career towards another way to make a living keeps you from like scrambling when you're my age and being like, oh shit, I don't know how else to make a living, but I need to know how to do that. So, you know, if you have a college degree in something, maybe get a little bit of job experience, even like a part-time job experience while you're also guiding, like something to fall back on, because, you know, your health, your physical health, you're an athlete, right? So your physical health is, you know, a fragile thing, and it's required if you're going to be out there guiding. So, yeah, not a bad idea to have some redundancy.
I thought you said, well, first I'd slap you until you don't do it.
No. Yeah, no, it's a rewarding, it's a really rewarding thing. I've gotten a lot out of it.
Well, I mean, just for me, posting some of the things about our part one and part two and reading the comments of people that you've guided and that, well, you've really impacted people's lives in a positive way. And it was really interesting and kind of neat to read through some of the comments that saying Brandon's the best, and, you know, and that you could really feel the love. And, you know, usually people don't just randomly put nice comments. They do it because there was something impactful in their life. And so that was really awesome to read.
Yeah. I'm really, really grateful that I've had the opportunity to, you know, just help so many people achieve like the, even if it was like the, just the one big lofty goal they had that year, or if it was like, you know, kind of a more, you know, season after season type of thing. You know, I'm just really grateful for that opportunity, you know, just that I was healthy and I was, you know, physically capable enough to do it all. And
yeah. And at the end of the day, if you boil this down, I mean, I know you're making money, but you're giving your life up, like, or not up, but you're the risk that you're giving to someone that, and at times that you don't even know, for them to reach their dreams, it's pretty incredible for sure.
Yeah. My strongest subjects in school were always history and gym class. I actually figured out a way. I actually talked with my principal when I was in high school. I was like, hey, if I eat lunch really fast, can I go and take another gym class? And he let me. So I was like, I would take two gym classes every day. and you know, like I got a chance to like, you know, use gym class. Like I was, you know, I'm just like good at using my body and, you know, helping other people out. And not many people get a chance to be like, yeah, gym class really paid the bills for a while.
Yeah. So, you know, I have a goal to climb Rainier. What do you think is the most essential mountaineering kind of beginner skill that I should master?
So I think that understanding the type of fitness that will be necessary is going to be what I would steer you towards here. The skills, like the, you know, the technical skills, like this, you know, using the equipment, that's all just going to be stuff that your guide is going to work with you. You know, they're going to essentially run you through like a boot camp and teach you like how to use the basic equipment in the way that you're going to need to use it for that trip, right? And that's going to be a good foundation. You don't need to stress about that before the trip at all. What you need to stress about before the trip is being fit. And there are different types of fit. So you need to be the correct type of fit. And so an example of not being the correct type of fit would be like doing like CrossFit or something. It's not that CrossFit's bad, but like if that's your sole like fitness model, like fitness like routine, that won't actually translate well to the type of fitness you're going to need for climbing Rainier. Even running isn't going to be really the type of fitness that you're going to need for climbing Rainier. But it's better, right? Like long distance running, right? Like would be better, but not, but still not the same. What you need to essentially do is train your body to run at very low intensity for a long time, right? So like most of your listeners are going to be hikers, right? So that's perfect. Go on long hikes with an emphasis on elevation gain. So lots and lots of elevation gain over long, long durations. So I would highly recommend that you just maximize the lengths of your days. So like I've got it a lot of folks that, you know, were like marathon runners and all, you know, ultra runners and stuff. And like, that is not necessarily the same. Just because the duration is not the same. Like you can run a marathon a lot faster than just one of the days associated with climbing Mount Rainier. So, you know, try and get as many like 8 to 10 hour pushes. That's really like what you need to be getting. 8 to 10 hours of good work in and lots of elevation gain. Don't be afraid to maybe put a little extra weight in your pack, you know, because your pack is going to be quite a bit heavier than like your standard hiking load. And yeah, just lean into it, you know.
What about weight training?
So I use strength training primarily like pre-season, just as I'm like getting into like particularly like when the seasons are like changing to a new discipline. So like if I've in the fall, I'm typically doing like a lot of rock climbing, and then which is all like upper body for the most part intensive, and then I roll into ski season in the early winter, and like my legs haven't really been doing that sort of like dynamic movement, nor have they been doing like the really long days of like low intensity vertical gain that you do when you're ski mountaineering. And so I'll do like a strength, like a pretty short strength training routine that just like kind of blasts that muscle group prior to starting to build the base. And that's just to like kind of build I do it for like durability, right? I think that like, if you kind of go into your season, like just being like physically strong, when you're training up your base, you're essentially like more resilient. You're less likely to get injured, right? You see that a lot when people are like starting a new season, they'll get some sort of weird injury because they weren't like strong enough. They like tweaked their knee or something. And then that kind of just like hinders their whole season. And so I've gotten really lucky with like just that model. And then I don't really do it like once the season's going. Like I pretty much stop with the strength training, you know, once the season's up and running.
Yeah, I think you'd probably get into fatigue as much as, you know, you're banging out the roots 3 or 4 times a week. That's strength enough. So outside of the normal things that I would have for hiking and backpacking, what are some gear choices that I would need for getting into mountaineering?
So it's going to be dependent on the route and type of mountaineering you're going to be getting involved in, but your pack will probably work for your first couple of climbs. You know, if you're going to be on like snow and ice, you may need to actually upgrade your pack, but you know, what I always like tell people is like, just like learn to sew or like bring your pack to like some, like a person that does, you know, sewing for a living and just have them put like a mountaineering axe attachment on your pack. Like, it's not that difficult of a thing to, I've modified multiple packs to add like an axe loop. And that's really the only thing that like I see when I'm in the mountains, like with beginners, is like, hey, like that's the only part of your pack I would like add something to. But most hiking packs are going to be fine for your first couple.
Yeah.
The mountaineering packs tend to carry the load a little bit different. And so it's going to be more oriented towards like technical maneuvering. So it's going to be tighter to your back. It's going to be a little more on your shoulders than like, you know, for your hips. They're not typically as comfortable, unfortunately. And then they also are typically less like, I call them like bells and whistles. Like a lot of hiking packs, like have a lot of pockets and compartments and, you know, things to clip things to and whatnot. Whereas like my mountaineering pack's just like a tube with a drawstring and a mountaineering axe on the back. So your pack might work, might not. You're definitely going to need a good pair of boots, you know? So if you're going to be, especially if you're going to be on snow. So it's either going to be mountaineering boots and, you know, reach out to me if you want advice on mountaineering boots. If you're in more of like a rocky type of range, like the Colorado or the Sierra or the Tetons or something like that, you might be looking at more of like an approach shoe. So you can like scramble up like granite slabs and stuff. And then, you know, if you're getting into the ice and snow, then you're going to probably need crampons, mountaineering axe, and everyone's going to need a helmet, and a harness. And then beyond that, everything's kind of like route dependent.
For the mountaineering axe, is there a certain length that it needs to be,
or that's a good question. Yeah.
A preference?
So I have like a whole like arsenal of axes.
You have to send me a picture.
Yeah, I'll send you a picture. Yeah, you'd love it. I think I have like 8 mountaineering axes.
Nice.
And they're just like different sizes and shapes, and the particularly the length has to do with like the steepness of the thing you're climbing. So like if I'm gonna be mostly like walking on like flat ground, or like flat for climbing terms, like Rainier is not very steep, so I'm gonna go with like a longer axe when I'm on Mount Rainier, because I want that to be like a third point of contact. So I'm going to be walking with my axe in my hand. So I'm going to use it as a cane. Right. So I want it to be longer. And then if I'm on something steeper, like, you know, Mount Hood or something like that, or Mount Shuckson, or, you know, you name it, I'm going to want something shorter so I can like short rope without having to like do this. And like, I can grab a hold of my, you know, my client's rope, and, you know, I keep everything like real close to the mountain. And then you've got like more like technical, you know, components, like, you know, like a pinky rest. You might have like a bent shaft, different types of picks. And that's all just for like, maybe like ice climbing or like more like steep snow oriented climbing. But I would say just like for the standard person who's just like, I need my first mountaineering axe, I would just say, you know, the standard, like hold, like when you're in the shop, just hold on to the axe in your, like the head of the axe, like where the pick comes out, and just, you know, let your hand hang down low, and the spike, so the bottom of the shaft, should be like at your ankle or so. And that would be like what I would recommend for like anyone's like first mountaineering axe, is just like from like the length of your like fist to like your ankle. And then just go with like a standard, like ADS. So like the, like an ADZ, ADZE actually, ADS. Yeah. ADZE. That's like a shovel kind of like scoop looking thing on the backside of the pick. And then it's like a standard curved pick. So no like fancy, you know, recurve or anything, and you don't need a hammer when you're first starting out either. That's the other thing you could have instead of an ADS, would be a hammer.
So every time I fly into Seattle to visit my daughter or John, I always go to an REI and I go to the ice axe aisle and I just want to buy one. I don't like my gear room needs an ice axe on the wall. I don't know I'll ever use it, but man, I want one. And I'll go grab them and hold them in my hand and man, and haven't bought one yet, but that's it's really funny that I always go and yeah, I just want to get one.
I love mountaineering axes. I share that same feeling. Like there, it just feels like when it's in your hand, it just feels so like primitive and like human, you know, like it's just there's just so much potential, you know,
yes.
In a mountaineering axe.
You feel like a badass.
Yeah. I make them. I know them. I started making
them. You do?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me know how much. No, I'm serious. When John took me Rainier and he gave me that ice axe and I had it in my hand, I mean, you just feel it's a feeling that very few times in my life have I ever felt. You just feel it's an incredible feeling. So what do you think are some of the biggest mistakes people make that are new to mountaineering when they're buying gear?
I think people buy too much too soon. And really, like, what you should do is just get like the bare minimum to go out and start getting experience. And that, like, and just like accept the fact that like you're going to go out and you're going to be like, oh, I wish I had this and I wish I had that. And that's exactly the point, right? Because like you'll know like what it'll keep you from buying things you don't really need. And then it'll also give you like a point of reference for like you now have some experience to be like, okay, like this is what I encountered out there. This is like, I need a piece of gear that like is made out of this and, you know, looks like this. And you know what I mean? Like it, rather than just like going to REI and just like going to each like department and picking out like the most expensive thing in each off each shelf, you know? Yeah. Just go out with the bare minimum and see what you actually do need.
So are there any new technologies in the mountaineering world that excite you?
Yeah. So I would say that the biggest advancements since I started have just been like material science. So like, you know, people are using like really lightweight metals now. And then I think that like computer modeling has just gotten really good at like taking like any extra material out that doesn't need to be there. So stuff has gotten like really light that used to be really heavy. Like a good example of like a new product. It's not even new anymore. It's probably like 5 years old now, but, Petzl makes like an aluminum crampon, and, you know, traditionally crampons had like and they still do for the most part. This is a pretty specialized item. So for all you listeners, like this is not your first crampon that you go out and buy because I was recommending it. This is just like an example of like a super, you know, specific crampon for a specific application. But it's an aluminum crampon. And then it's instead of it being held together because it's two different parts, one on, it goes on your heel and one on your forefoot. Instead of it being like a steel bar that would go there, right there, it's two little strands of Dyneema cord that hold the crampon together. So like it's Dyneema is really, really strong. So it's not going anywhere. It's super strong. But it's just like a very like, wow, like why didn't I think of that? You know, type of thing. And with that, like, you know, like ropes have gotten like extremely light, extremely thin, for how strong they are. So yeah, we're just at like a really exciting time. I think that like climbing, having gone like fully mainstream, just brought a whole lot of money into the industry. And with all that money, it drove competition and competition drove, you know, advancement in technology, you know, to compete. So You know, in particular, like I know that the stuff that Edelrid, a company called Edelrid, for quite a while, they were putting out like super, like it was like aliens were making this stuff. It was like way lighter, way better than everyone else's stuff for a while. It was cool. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Yeah. Material science.
So what do you think is the most overrated or useless piece of gear that you see people have on the mountain?
I would say that the piece of gear that I see the most in being carried and used in the most useless ways would be people will often have like a anchor, like a dedicated, like a lanyard that goes from your harness to a carabiner. And they use that to like clip into anchors with. And the classic model of it is called a PAS, a personal anchor system. But like, there's been all these different iterations. Like every company makes one of these and they do have an application, but I would say that 9 times out of 10, I see that being used in a useless manner, right? Like you shouldn't even have brought it. Like here we are like way up in the mountains and you've got a PAS on your harness. Right. But like even at the crag, like people use it when they don't need to. And, you know, it's like, again, it has an application, but I see it get used. It's one of those things that people think they need right away. It's like, clearly you're going to need a personal anchor system. Yeah. But it's not true at all. Like you don't need that piece of equipment. There's plenty of other things that you're going to have with you that you can make a personal anchor system, you know, with. So yeah, that would be my vote for that.
All right. We're wrapping up. So are you ready for the lightning round?
I'm ready.
So these are short answers, quick, and we'll see how fast we get through it. So first question, rock or snow?
What kind of rock? Like good rock, like granite, like beautiful Sierra?
Yes, beautiful rock and beautiful snow.
I would say beautiful, solid rock.
Technical rock climb or steep snow slog?
I would say technical rock climb, yeah.
Roped glacier travel or solo ridge scramble?
I kind of like hanging out on glaciers. So yeah, I would go with roped glacier travel.
All right. Ice climbing with tools or mixed climbing?
I like mixed climbing.
Crevasse jump or fixed line rappel?
Crevasse jump for sure.
All right. Summit day or route finding day?
I don't like waking up in the middle of the night. So I most summit days I don't like, but if it's not an alpine start, then it would always be summit day, I suppose.
What do you love most about Clarkia?
I love the fact that Clarkia just sees unwaveringly sees the best, you know, in things. So she's just got a really positive attitude, and I wish it was more contagious on me, but it's pretty contagious. So I like, you know, I'm a little bit pessimistic, so she definitely brings up my optimism quite a bit. And I mean, she's opened my eyes to like a lot more, like this, like beauty that I've just like not even taken in, especially in the mountains, right? Like when we're out, she's just like, look at this. And I'm like, oh yeah, look at this. This is pretty great. You know, and she'll be like, do you see that bird? And, you know, it's just like, you know, it's just like things I just like, just didn't even think about.
To the listeners, Brandon, his face is glowing. So vertical gain or long distance approach?
Oh, for sure. Vertical gain.
Lightweight and risky or heavy and prepared?
Lightweight and risky.
So about the weather, cold and dry or warm and stormy?
Cold and dry or warm and stormy. It's usually going to be cold and stormy for me, but since that's not an option, I will go with cold and dry.
Let's say you're not in the Pacific Northwest. Rope team leader or tail end sweeper?
Rope team leader for sure.
Rock helmet always or only when it looks bad?
I would say if I'm at all concerned that things might come down and hit me on the head, then I would say rock helmet.
Guiding first timers or guiding seasoned climbers?
Guiding seasoned climbers.
Camp above tree line or bivy on a ledge?
Bivy on a ledge.
Favorite summit treat?
Day old pizza.
All right. What is your best take a break drink in the mountains?
Can I say old fashioned?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, an old fashioned while you're guiding clients on hood.
Now while I'm guiding.
Okay.
There's one client out there that maybe we've had a few drinks out there, but that's just, you know, just the one.
Pick your poison, altitude sickness or frostbite.
Ugh, I got to pick one of those?
Mm-hmm.
I would rather have altitude sickness.
All right. Altitude headache or sunburned lips?
Altitude headache.
Crampon strap breaks or ice axe left behind?
Oh, I can fix a broken crampon. I've fixed one of those before in the field. So I would definitely say I would rather have my crampon strap break.
Avalanche conditions or rockfall warnings?
I would rather deal with avalanches than rockfall.
Sketchy snow bridge or unstable scree field?
Am I roped in for the sketchy snow bridge?
Yes.
Yeah, then I would do the sketchy snow bridge probably.
Overnight at high camp with no stove or no insulation, and it's a cold night.
No stove.
If you could only climb one more mountain, what would it be?
Oof, man, I don't even know. I don't want to climb just one more mountain. I don't know. I don't even know how to answer that.
All right. I like this one. Belay partner won't shut up or won't say a word?
Won't shut up.
All right. Frozen zipper on a tent or frozen fingers and gloves?
Frozen zipper on a tent for sure.
Last lightning round question. What is your favorite Texas hiking podcast?
This one.
That's the right answer. All right. Last two questions. These are tradition, and I always end the episodes with them. So, what is one piece of gear you would recommend to anyone new to mountaineering? The very first piece of gear that they should purchase.
New to mountaineering. Probably your, man, either your axe or your helmet. Maybe your helmet. Go out and get a helmet. Your mom will appreciate it.
Absolutely. Last question. What is one piece of safety advice you would give to anyone new to mountaineering?
Just take it slow. Mountaineering is a long game sport. If you're not patient, you're not going to like the sport. So just take it slow and remember that like the summits are going to happen, but it's not, you're going to find out that the summits aren't really that important.
I like it. Nice. Well, Brandon, I greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast and talking about mountaineering, guiding. Again, you know, I'm infatuated with this activity. I hope, you know, that before I hang up my backpack, that I will have experienced a lot more of it than I have. Golly, we've been on this episode. We've got four parts now, so 4 hours. I can't thank you enough for putting things in your life on hold to come on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and that you were always welcome back on the podcast to talk about any and everything that you're doing in the mountains. So again, thank you so much.
You bet, Jason. Thanks so much. This is a blast. Appreciate you giving me a chance to put a lot of words to all these things I've been thinking about.
Absolutely. And I hope that after this, that the industry changes a little bit for the positive.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. Well, take care.
All right. See you, Jason.
And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode today and stay tuned for our next episode where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.